I'll call the February 26, 2025 meeting of the House Public Safety Committee to order. A quorum is present. If we don't complete our work today, the committee's adjournment time at 4:45, we will recess and reconvene at 6:30 tonight or at the call of the chair in this room, 120. Before we conduct our meeting, I want to remind everyone that the committee expects proper decorum at all times. All dialogue goes through the chair. Signs are not allowed in the committee room. There will be no outbursts or clapping. There's no standing or sitting in walkways and aisles. If accommodations are needed, communicate with sergeant staff. There will be consequences if there is a disruption. Thank you to the sergeant at arms who are presenting for helping maintain decorum during the committee hearing. Representative Greenman, have you had a chance to review the minutes of the 2025 meeting? Or
Representative Moeller? Sorry, Mr. Chair, I have not.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the minutes.
Representative Moeller moves for approval of the February 2025 minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion carries, and the minutes of the February 25th, 2025 meeting are approved. First bill on the agenda today is House File 284. Chair Heinzman, please come to the table with your testifier. Chair Heinzman, we have not received a fiscal note yet on this bill, so we will be laying it over for today. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. House File 284 is a bill to bring us into federal compliance. The language in the bill is not something that just suddenly arrived. It's been discussed, and I think nearly at that point where it was going to become law. And I'm not familiar with the reasons that it may or may not have been successful, but I do want to try to take another shot at complying with some federal laws. So after learning that the ATF determined that our statute creating questions on the carry permit application was insufficient, this bill became imperative to put us in compliance. House File 284 adds a line as directed by ATF's open letter, which I think is included in your packets, dated October 23, 2019. So as I was suggesting, going back quite a ways, this is something that was suggested that we do and to try and comply. So by passing this bill, Minnesota becomes federally compliant, and our statute will conform with what ATF expects from the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. And please have your testifier state his full name for the record and begin.
Sure. My name is Sheriff Brian Welk. Good afternoon, Chair Novotny, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Sheriff's Association, representing all 87 sheriffs across our great state. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 284. A bill I requested after identifying a significant flaw in the background check process for Minnesota permit to carries. Our office processed a permit to carry for an individual who at the time met the criteria under our current search. However, upon conducting an annual review, I discovered that this person had an active felony federal warrant for straw purchasing firearms. And this was issued and investigated by the ATF. Further investigation revealed that the individual was a Canadian citizen who had twice applied for U.S. citizenship and was denied. This case exposed a critical gap in the background check system. The current MyVCA portal does not verify an applicant's immigration status. HF 284 seeks to address this gap by requiring an immigration alien query check. As part of the permit to carry background process, this check provides real-time verification of an applicant's legal immigration status, ensuring that individuals prohibited from possessing firearms under federal law are properly identified. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association looks forward to working with our justice partners and legislators to refine and strengthen this bill as it moves forward. Thank you for the time to testify today, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Questions for the testifier or Chair Heinzman? Lead Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Heinzman. I guess the question I have is, what does ICE do with the information once it's submitted to the sheriff, or the sheriff submits it to ICE?
Chair Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Moeller.
Can you pull the mic just a little closer? Thank you.
Yeah, I sure can. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Moeller, for the question. That's a question that I think ATF is working towards trying to resolve in this, and I would defer to my testifier, maybe House Research. My testifier sounds like, or looks like, may have more info on that, Mr. Chairman.
We'll start out with Sheriff Walt.
Sure. So if I understand it correct, you're asking, like, once we do the application and submit it, where does that information come from and go? Great question. So the MyBCA portal checks all the things that are required currently, including civil commit, all that stuff. So it would be added on that template, and that's a query that would be sent right to the database federally that goes to ICE, and it would come back to us instantly, just like a driver's license, a NICS check, NCIC check, a civil commit check, instead of like previously when we did civil commits, you'd have to send paperwork in and wait for something to come back. This is instantaneous. You know exactly right now the database is already there. We just don't have the authorization to do it. And, you know, when we issue a permit to purchase, permit to carry, we're responsible for that information and making determinations without all the information. I don't want to be giving someone a permit that shouldn't have one.
Lee Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I guess my question is more about what ICE does with the information once you send that to ICE. Obviously, they run the check that they need to verify the information, but now you're giving them information, right, that someone has applied for a permit to carry in your county. Do you know what ICE does with that information?
From what I am told, from when I called the Border Patrol agent I was working with on this, and it's just like a driver's license check. They wouldn't get anything. They input the information from their A number or their alien number, and that determines what they are. That happens already when they go back and forth over the border. They're assigned them numbers. That just checks and verifies by name if that person is or isn't, whether it's Brian Welk is being checked, says no record found. If Brian Welk is found, then it would give me my alien number or whatever. It just verifies, yep, he's here legally. And there's two different statuses that you can have. Are you here as a permanent resident or are you here visiting? And there's also a provision in there if you're hunting, you know, you can have a firearms to engage in that with no issues. And the same if you're a permanent resident, and I believe they call it a lapper, you are also able to possess a firearm or purchase one. But if you are not one of those two designations, it's not lawful to have a firearm or purchase them. So we have no way of knowing that one way or other.
Lead Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand all of that and appreciate it for what you're trying to do here. I think what I'm trying to get at is you're alerting ICE that this person is applying for a permit to carry, and you want to know, you're going to give them the alien number to make sure they can do the checks, but you're letting them know you're doing the checks because they're applying for a permit to carry. And then I don't really know what ICE does with that information other than sending back to you whether or not, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down. But now they have information that there is someone that's applying for a permit to carry in Minnesota who is a lawful permanent resident or has some other legal status. And I guess that's the part of this that concerns me, because I don't know what ICE is going to do with that information later, other than, you know, in addition to complying with what they need to do.
Sure, and that can be with anything.
Sheriff Welk.
Oh, sorry. Just like when we run a criminal history, who does that notify? When we input a stolen vehicle, it notifies the agency that it's there. To my knowledge, there wouldn't be any notification to ICE or anything. We're simply checking a database. I don't know and couldn't speak to that intelligently if that gives them a hit or not. I don't know.
Lead Mullen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and I think that's the troubling thing is that we don't know what ICE is doing with that, and it's different to me than sending the information, say, to the BCA and asking them to do the regular criminal background check because of where we are in this country right now and what ICE is doing and what ICE is being asked to do. We're hearing stories of people who are being picked up in courthouses, that sort of thing. And so I guess because it's ICE, there's a little bit more of a heightened concern. And it would be great to try to get some information about what they do with that information once they have it.
Sure, and that's the critical
piece.
Sure,
well.
Sorry. I'll get this down one time. And I think that's critical of when they're filling out the application. They're aware of what happens. They sign to it intelligently. The case that I had, we manage the data for 5 years for a permit to carry, and we check it annually. This particular case wasn't found until year four. So we go back and look and say, okay, he signed in his name, he did all that, but there's a 3-year statute of limitations. We can't do anything to hold the accountable for a false application.
Chair Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the question, Lead Mueller, but at the end of the day, what we're looking at is confirming that when someone is attempting to access a firearm, that we have, number one, compliance with federal expectations, and that we're doing everything possible to make sure that if that firearm can be legally obtained, that we're following that process. And I think we all agree that it makes sense to check and double check as best we can and follow the ATF's determination as they're seeing that we have a problem in this process and we are not compliant, and we want to close that loophole.
Chair Mueller, or Lead Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I appreciate that, and I want to make sure that people who shouldn't have guns don't have guns. It's just, I would really like some clarity around what ICE does with that information. Other than respond to you, what are they keeping it for, using it for, et cetera? Are they keeping a registry of LPRs that have permits to carry? Like, I don't know the answer to that, and I think it would be helpful to get that information.
Chair Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So again, Lead Mueller, this bill's being laid over. And there's a number of other, well, at least one other bill that you and I are going to be, I think, looking more closely at. I'm happy to work with you on this if there's questions that remain as this bill potentially makes its way through the process.
Good. Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. My question to the sheriff, can you call ICE right now to do a verification?
No.
Sheriff Walt.
Not that I'm aware of. We don't have access to run that alien identification number.
Can you do any query? Sorry.
Representative no. Witte. Sheriff Walt.
not that I'm aware of.
Representative Witte.
Thank you. I'm learning. So as I'm looking at the Minnesota firearm application permit to carry a pistol, one of the restrictions on the back kind of puts you guys in a box if you don't have the information. And so you're the one passing out the information. You're just asking us to help. And obviously, you don't want to put the firearm in someone who shouldn't have it. And I think it's must not be an alien who is illegal or unlawfully in the United States. So all you're trying to do is verify the information, correct?
Absolutely.
Sheriff Welk.
Absolutely. Yeah, and, you know, this case started out in my county, and I personally was affected by this. The person that we had given a permit to had bought 29 guns, and the ATF found him on a search warrant that he had sold to gang members. And the ATF asked me, Sheriff, why did he have a permit to carry from your agency? And I pulled all the paperwork, and I'm like, well, the first thing was I looked at his driver's license with Minnesota ID for all. There's no verification to say that he's supposed to be in Cass County, Minnesota. so they could do a real ID because that verifies that. So then when we were on the criminal history, it says citizenship unknown. Then the further you check, there's no wants, there's no warrants, there's no criminal history that would prohibit him from being a possessor. So I can't deny that, because once my obligation, when I go there and do our investigation and I deny it and they take me to court and I lose, I have to pay all the legal fees too. So there's all that, that if we can get the information and make an intelligent conclusion as to if they should have a firearm or not, why wouldn't we?
Representative Wade.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. So in the end, we learned this yesterday from the Commissioner of Public Safety. If someone gets sued, it's your name on the top of that lawsuit.
Absolutely. And
Sheriff Welk,
you'll learn.
Absolutely. And that, you know, in something like that where an innocent person gets hurt, it's going to be all over the media and I'll have no chance to explain what happened.
Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. And thank you, Sheriff, for telling us what we can do to help you to keep our community safe.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Heinzman, for bringing the bill. Maybe I'm missing it, but I don't see in the language of the bill any reference to ICE, and it could be for either you or your testifier. What's the mechanism by which ICE would get information about an applicant through this inquiry process? Sheriff Walt.
Thank you. You know, the information comes from the application that we would input. We would have no direct contact with ICE. It would just be getting information from their database that already exists from their input.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think the point to be made here is that it's information that's volunteered by the individual for the purpose of obtaining a carry permit. Chair Heinzman, in your view, what type of person would be seeking a carry permit that would somehow be in fear of a negative consequence as a result of that query being performed? I'm just trying to flesh out the picture here.
Chair Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. So that's, I think, a reasonably easy question, but I hesitate to answer directly. I would hope that the person that is seeking access to a firearm is a law-abiding citizen and does not have a felony somewhere that we're unable to see under the current check. But it does sound as though that this bill is needed, this legislation is needed to make sure that we're checking every box and we're in compliance with the ATF's request from now 2019.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have another question unrelated to that concern. As someone who is not myself in FFL or engages in a lot of these types of transactions, I'm curious what the lack of conformity with federal law, how that actually plays out and affects people's lives as they're trying to engage in these transactions.
Sheriff Welk.
Can I get the question again?
Representative,
can you ask the question,
please, the question?
Yeah, I can report. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question was the current lack of conformity with federal law that this bill seeks to correct, how does that impact real people's lives? Like, why is it important for this bill to pass, for us to get into conformity with federal law, which we haven't been since 2019?
Sheriff Walt.
Yeah, absolutely. In my case alone, and I'm one of 87 sheriffs in the county, there's 29 guns on the street that shouldn't have been.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Steer, quick question.
All right, so I might have some knowledge in this. So for the last 2 years,
thank you.
You yell at me constantly. Yeah. Okay, so for the last 2 years, I've been the advisory policy board for the FBI, their database, criminal justice information systems. And this database already exists in the federal system. That's all the state is doing, or what we're trying to do here is to run the database check to see if they're an illegal alien and if they can get a gun permit. It doesn't trigger anything to ICE. It just says to the sheriff, this is either an illegal alien or their citizen. That's it. So we're not the sheriff. There's nothing in here that said the sheriff has to call ICE. It's not a trigger. There's nothing that flags ICE that says this was wrong. So.
That sounded like a statement, not a question.
Sorry, Sheriff, is that accurate?
Sheriff Welk.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative, our lead Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right, I appreciate those questions, but I think the question still remains once that database, the immigration alien query check, is run on the federal end, what do they do with that information on the federal end? And I would just like to get that information before the bill, before we bring this bill up again another time.
Representative Heisman, the comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm, as I said earlier, happy to follow up with Lead Mueller to ascertain exactly what that might look like. Is it how the information is shared or not shared? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I just want to point out, this is something that's been going on. Obviously, the letter we first had was from 2019, and this has been going on. There's been bills put forward during multiple administrations. So with that, thank you, Chair, or Chair Heinzman. And as I said, this will be moving on. So this will be laid on the table. Is laid House File 284 is laid over. Thank you, Chair Heinzman, and your testifier. The next bill on our agenda is House File 13. Chair Bliss, if you could step up to the table. Chair Bliss, since you are a member of this committee, would you like to move your bill with a recommendation that is re-referred to the General Register?
Thank you. Yes, that would be what I'd like to do.
Chair Bliss, please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My bill is a rather simple bill. It adds just one item to the existing statute, and it says that an actor may use reasonable force under circumstances described in paragraph A, clause 3, regardless of the reasonability of possibility of retreat to avoid danger exists. And number 3 is when used by any person in resisting or aiding another to resist an offense against the person. And this bill really came forward to us from a case recently in the Supreme Court where a gentleman was in a train station, I believe a light rail transit station, and he had three gentlemen that surrounded him, told him to step out of the camera view so they could slice his throat. He pulled out a machete and just displayed it, and he was safe after that, but he was found guilty for displaying a weapon. And Justice Thiessen, as you might know, is a former Speaker of the House in the Minnesota House of Representatives. I got to serve with Justice Thiessen, and he was a rather reasonable guy. And he wrote the dissent to this ruling, and he starts out, you know, it just says that this is unique, that it's never been done before, and that the court really takes, in this decision, takes the term reasonableness and moves it out of the court's jurisdiction before, in the statute it says use of reasonable force may be used. And nowhere in the statute, by the way, currently does it say duty to retreat. That's just something the court added later. And he had an example that he wrote. This was Justice Thiessen's example. He said, consider it a scenario in which a woman is at a train station. A man approaches and threatens to stab her. Assume that, like Blevins, the defendant in this case, She had a reasonable opportunity to retreat by walking away. She actually, honestly, and reasonably believes that she is in danger of imminent death or great bodily harm. She has a can of pepper spray in her purse and brandishes it to ward off just such an aggression. In the response, the man is afraid and backs off. She gets on the next train and is later arrested for assaulting the man by causing fear of bodily harm. Again, that comes from Justice Thiessen's dissent. And I think that there's other examples in there. We're the only place in the United States, the only state that requires the need to find a way out or duty to retreat, even in just the threat to your aggressor. No other state in the union does that. And in this case with Blevin, he did not attack the other gentleman. He just threatened with a weapon, and he was found guilty. This bill just simply codifies in statute that we can do that, and reasonableness is still the level at which the judge and juries can decide if he just calls me a name and I felt threatened, I can shoot him. No, this bill does nothing like that. It still leaves the reasonableness to the judge and the jury, and that's my bill.
Chair Bliss, you have some testifiers on your side, and we are aware of several people that have signed up as testifiers in opposition to this bill, and the vice versa on some of the amendments that are being offered. So we're going to run those right now. And speaking with Lead Moeller, we have agreed that we will allow 15 minutes per side, and we will begin with the two testifiers in support of your bill, Brian Ghosh from the NRA and Rob Dorr from the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. Testifiers, please step up to the table. At 15 minutes, we have no other testifiers. We did have one that was withdrawn, but you have 15 minutes. Mr. Ghosh, begin your testimony. State your full name and state your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rob Dorr. I'm the Vice President of the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. I won't repeat kind of what precipitated this bill, but Justice Thiessen was right that the decision in his dissent, the Blevins decision, flies in the face of human nature. With the latest iteration of the duty to retreat from the higher courts, it places this unthinkable burden that before even presenting counterforce, somebody must seek retreat. And instinctively, if somebody was to try to throw a punch in your face, you're going to put your hands up. You're going to try to find some counterforce to the threat that's facing you. And this decision says, now you have to retreat before even evaluating that counterforce. Minnesota self-defense law is a mess. The duty to retreat is not something that this body has ever passed. It's something that's been created and further confused by the judicial branch. It first appears in 1967 with State versus Johnson that had to do with whether a reluctant participant includes a duty to retreat. That was further clarified what constitutes a reluctant participant in State versus Baker. State versus Basting in 1997 actually firmly laid out the four elements for the use of force, which included duty to retreat. But then the question was, well, do you have to retreat in your own home? Does the duty to retreat exist in your own home? That was in 1997 with State versus Pendleton. Then the question was, well, what about common areas of an apartment building? Is that is that somewhere where you have the duty to retreat? And that was in State versus Hicks in 1998. Then the question was, well, what about the hallway of an apartment building? Does that constitute somewhere where you need your duty to retreat? That's going to be answered in State versus Devens from, 2014. And then how serious does the threat have to be before you need to retreat? That'd be State versus Carruthers in 1999. And then you, what if the co-aggressor lives with you? Do you have a duty to retreat if the person actually lives with you? That's State versus Glowacki in 2001. And then there's more and more and more cases that all surround the duty to retreat in Minnesota. So in order to have a comprehensive understanding of when and when not you have the right to use self-defense, you have to understand a mountain of case law relevant to your situation. You have to analyze that in the microsecond that you have to decide whether you can present deadly force or whether you're obligated to retreat in that situation. I don't think this is a workable situation, and whether it's with Representative Bliss's bill or another bill, it's long past time that the legislature clarify what the elements are for the right to use deadly force in self-defense. But this also doesn't just include deadly force. It doesn't only include firearms. It's if you're using your vehicle in order to try to avoid an aggressor, or a machete, as was the case in this. In some instances, it could be argued that less than lethal weapons couldn't still constitute deadly force. It's time for the confusion to end and for the legislature to make it very clear to peaceable, law-abiding Minnesotans what has to happen in order for them to lawfully use deadly force without needing to read dozens of case law in order to understand it. Thank you.
Thank you. Next testifier, Mr. Ghosh, please say your full name.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the Public Safety Committee. My name is Brian Ghosh. I'm a lawyer, registered lobbyist for the National Rifle Association, here today in support of House File 13. I want to thank the prime sponsor for bringing this important bill for all Minnesotans. And if I may have a little bit of levity, Mr. Chair, I'd like to do a shout out to Big John Holtquist. I know he's nursing some family back to health today. If he's listening, I want you to know our thoughts and prayers are with you.
I'm sure he is.
I am a state director in Minnesota, but also four other states. And in those other states, there is no duty to retreat. In fact, it goes further. You have the right to stand your ground. If you search the headlines, you're not going to find problems in those states where they allow stand your ground. 2 years ago, that would be North Dakota's last session. They were one of the last remaining red states, if you will, to remove the duty to retreat. There was opposition testimony in committee against removing the duty to retreat. There was some suggestion, even from a prosecutor, that we were going to be legalizing bar fights. I challenge you again to find headlines in North Dakota where bar fights have been legalized or people aren't being prosecuted for assault in those situations. Some of the opposition testimony like that occurred in South Dakota when a couple years ago South Dakota became the strongest stand your ground language in the land, guaranteeing that you have the right to protect yourselves and your loved ones. Again, if you search the headlines, you're not going to find problems in South Dakota for giving citizens the right to defend themselves. I would venture to guess if you were to pass this, and this is a limited version of removing the duty to retreat, it doesn't apply in all situations. It's a narrow version for defense of yourself or others. I would venture to guess you're not going to find problems with that. In fact, your voting constituency is going to thank you for that right to make sure that they don't go to jail for protecting themselves or their family. I want to throw out an example that happened in Texas, a terrible tragedy back in 2017, Sutherland Springs, where a church shooting occurred. At the time, Texas didn't allow carrying of firearms in churches, complete ban. And so the law-abiding citizens who went to hear the word of God that day did not carry any guns. 36 people were killed, 22 wounded, and that's even with law enforcement arriving within minutes. 2 years later, Texas changed the law, allowed carrying in churches. Another church shooting occurred. The reason I bring this up is because what if in Texas they had a duty to retreat on the second occasion as well? So when this bad guy shot two people inside the church, the armed parishioner pulled out his sidearm and with one shot ended the violence. Now, under the Minnesota standard as established by the court, and as previous testimony indicated, this is a manufactured standard. It's not in law. It's not something that you, the policymakers, put in place. It's something that the judges and the courts did. But if that had been in place in Texas, before the armed parishioner could have ended the violence, he would have had to look to see if he himself could retreat and get out of there without being harmed himself. And I don't think that that's good public policy. I think we want to encourage good Samaritans. We want to encourage people to protect themselves and others in a reasonable and prudent way. And if you have a carry permit in Minnesota, you had to have undergone some firearm training and shooting accuracy training. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand by for questions, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Ghosh. And if you guys could step up, we'll bring up the next testifiers. Maggie Emery from Protect Minnesota, and Sarah Erickson, you are on deck. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maggie Emery, and I'm the executive director of Protect Minnesota, which is the only state-based, statewide gun violence prevention organization in our state. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak before you today. I'm here to strongly oppose HF 13, the proposed Shoot First legislation before you today. This bill would legalize unnecessarily violence, increase gun deaths, and exacerbate already existing racial disparities. The data from other states where this legislation has been enacted shows that Shoot First laws do not deter crime or make communities safer. Instead, they escalate violence, endanger neighborhoods, and make everywhere we go more dangerous. There's overwhelming evidence that Shoot First laws significantly increase homicides. A 2013 study found these laws were associated with a 6 to 11% increase in homicide rates. Similarly, a 2017 study found Shoot First laws that remove the duty to retreat lead to an 8% increase in firearm homicide. In a time when our statewide firearm deaths are up nearly 40% since 2019, can we really afford laws that would create more deadly encounters? One good case study here for us is Florida, which has had Shoot First laws in effect for almost two decades. The implementation of this law there was associated with a 32% increase in firearm homicide rates and a 24% increase in overall homicides. These increases aren't anomalies. They reflect a pattern seen in multiple states that have enacted similar legislation. When people are encouraged to shoot first and ask questions later, we create an environment where conflicts that could have been resolved peacefully quickly turn deadly. Research from RAND and the American Bar Association shows clearly any claim that this law would enhance public safety is false. These studies show that these laws embolden aggressive behavior, increase the likelihood of violent confrontations. A study from Texas A&M University found that rather than deterring crimes such as burglary, robbery, and aggravated assault, shoot first laws lead to a rise in violent crime and homicide. One tragic example is the case of Marquise McLaughlin in Florida. He was shot and killed in a parking lot after a minor altercation over a parking space. The shooter, Michael Draca, was initially shielded by Florida shoot first law, even though McLaughlin was retreating when he was shot. Such cases highlight how Shoot First encourages individuals to take matters into their own hands instead of relying on law enforcement and peaceful conflict resolution. Do we really want to live in a state where people are routinely shot to death over parking spaces? Another deeply troubling aspect of Shoot First laws is their racially biased application. Studies show this law regularly disproportionately favors white shooters who kill black victims. According to the Urban Institute, when a white shooter kills a black person, the homicide is 350% more likely to be ruled justified than if the roles were reversed. Similarly, the Tampa Bay Times found the defendants in Florida were 73% more likely to achieve dismissal under Shoot First if the victim was black, compared to 59% if the victim was white. Shoot First does not apply equally to all people. It exacerbates the racial biases already present here in Minnesota, putting communities of color at even greater risk. This law would also make Minnesota more unsafe for law enforcement. It would make it more difficult to hold perpetrators accountable, increase the risk to officers responding to incidents, and undermine public safety. When individuals feel emboldened to use deadly force rather than de-escalate or retreat from dangerous situations, law enforcement is left to navigate an environment where the threshold for legal self-defense becomes dangerously low. And the consequences of Shoot First extend beyond initial confrontations. A study in the journal Injury Prevention found that Florida's law led to a 45% increase in homicides among adolescents 15 to 19 years old. If Minnesota follows the paths of states that have adopted these laws, we can expect similar outcomes. More young lives lost to gun violence and more families devastated by preventable tragedies. Gun violence is already the number one cause of death for children and teens in our country. We want Minnesota to be a leader in many things, but childhood deaths from gun violence is not one of them. Don't enact legislation that would put us in the running. Minnesota has a long track record of taking public safety seriously. We should not now import failed policies that have made other states more dangerous. Shoot first laws have been thoroughly studied and the results are clear. They do not deter crime. Instead, they increase homicides, escalate conflict, deepen racial disparities, and put both civilians and law enforcement at greater risk. We must prioritize policies that reduce violence, encourage de-escalation, and ensure fair application of the law for everyone in Minnesota. I urge this committee to reject Shoot First legislation and keep our community safe. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Sarah Erickson.
Chair Novotny, members of the Public Safety Committee, my name is Sarah Erickson, and I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 13 today. On behalf of Gabby Giffords' group, her National Gun Violence Prevention. Giffords is a leader in this movement to end gun violence in America. She's a former congresswoman, and her team brings decades of political, legal, and policy expertise to the fight for safety. First, we do not believe House File 13 will have the intended impact of deterring crime, as proponents say. In fact, Shoot First legislation has repeatedly been shown to increase homicide rates. Instead of enhancing public safety, it will create a dangerous environment where deadly force is more readily used in situations that could have been de-escalated. According to the American Public Health Association from 2021, evidence exists that contradicts claims that expanding self-defense laws deters violent crime in the United States. In at least some contexts, including in Florida, stand your ground laws are associated with the increase in violence, and there are racial inequities in the application of these laws. Second, the Shoot First laws will alter the legal standard, in cases where an individual knew they could safely remove themselves from a situation to avoid harm. Removing the duty to retreat from Minnesota law will make it easier for individuals who exercise deadly force to justify their actions. While we all share the goal of reducing violence in our communities, this bill is far from the solution we need right now in Minnesota, and I urge the committee to reject House File 13, and I thank the committee for their time. And very briefly, having just kind of read the case very quickly before I sat down, I don't know that I think that the question was whether or not the gentleman pulled the machete to defend himself. The issue became when the gentleman continued to follow the three individuals for another minute brandishing his machete. So I think there, I just wanted to be clear, I think there's a difference in maybe what we're trying to solve with this bill. Thank you. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Last testifier listed is a Don Einwalter. Thank you. Have a seat and please state your name for the record.
My name is Don Einwalter. Good afternoon, Chair Novotny, committee members and staff. Thank you for hearing my testimony. I am testifying today because HF 13 is a dangerous gun bill that will roll back current safety protections in Minnesota, make it so that individuals can use deadly force in certain situations. Where
can you pull the mic just a little closer, ma'am?
Yes, I'll scoot up.
Thank you.
I am a member of the Hamlin Midway Coalition Board, the City of St. Paul's Neighborhood Safety Community Council, and I am the group lead for the St. Paul Group of Moms Demand Action. I also live in the Midway, a diverse urban neighborhood in the heart of St. Paul that has experienced public safety challenges in the last year. The Hamlin Midway Coalition has hosted community meetings, including one attended by over 400 people to gather input and feedback on the challenges facing our neighborhood. As neighbors, we are working together with local agencies to address these problems. Specifically, we're working with Metro Transit, the St. Paul Police Department, the City's Office of Neighborhood Safety, and the City's Department of Safety and Inspections to address hotspots. There is now a visible and reliable law enforcement presence. Residents are engaging in cleanup, reporting incidents, and helping to identify care for their vulnerable neighbors. Our community is deeply invested in creating solutions to promote public safety for everyone. Stoking fear and potentially adding more firearms into the mix would make an already volatile situation more so. As has been mentioned, Stand Your Ground is a policy that gives people a license to kill, allowing them to use deadly force in public as a first option rather than the last. Thinking back to the tragic shootings of Trayvon Martin in Florida and Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, shoot first laws like this promote dangerous vigilantism by encouraging people to use violence as a first, not a last resort. Minnesota's current existing law does not prohibit a person from using deadly force if they believe it is necessary to protect against serious harm. It merely requires a person to take an alternative course of action when they are in a threatening situation. Traditional self-defense principles reflect the value of life while still giving a person the right to protect themselves when necessary. To bring it back to the Midway, neighbors in the Midway are focused on looking out for one another. Trained law enforcement is monitoring our hotspot in collaboration with actively engaged residents. A law like HF 13 would not be an advantage in the Midway, but would be further destabilizing. I encourage members of the committee to vote no on HF 13 and retain all current provisions of Minnesota's traditional self-defense law. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you to all the testifiers for coming forward. We have two amendments. First Amendment's A1, who will be offering that? Representative Hollins, please describe your amendment.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. This amendment is the Safe and Secure Storage of Firearms Amendment. It is the same bill that we brought forward last year that had been negotiated. We accepted several different amendments changing it. And I thought it was going to get across the finish line last year, and it just didn't make it. So I am hoping that we can have a good conversation about it. May I continue?
Yes.
Thank you so much. And before I forget, I would like to request a roll call on this. So first of all, I feel like I need to ground us in the fact that the leading cause of death among children in the U.S. is guns. In most other developed nations, it is respiratory disease, it is infectious disease. There are a host of different reasons why children die, but in the U.S., it is guns. And I remember this bill coming forward last year and thinking that it made a lot of sense. As a lawful gun owner, I keep my gun stored securely. And I thought it was common sense, and I was really excited that it was moving forward. Unfortunately, it didn't quite cross the finish line. And that led me to start paying closer attention to what was happening in the news. So I want to tell folks a little bit about what happened in the news between the time that we adjourned in session and to now. In July of last year, a six-year-old shot himself in Wabasha County because a shotgun was left loaded and unsecured in a car while his parents were not in there. In September, a 16-year-old shot his teenage friend in New Hope, Minnesota. In October, a 3-year-old boy in Northeast Minneapolis accidentally shot himself. In November, a 13-year-old boy in Minneapolis killed himself accidentally with a gun that was left over after a party had happened the night before. In December, a 3-year-old in Otter Tail County shot himself. In Minnesota, firearms are found in over a third of the households, with more than half of them unlocked and 20% stored loaded. So despite all the active shooter drills that we have in our schools, almost 90% of gun deaths happen at home. It goes without saying that active shootings that happen in schools are horrifying and terrible. But also, it is a boogeyman that is forcing us to look the wrong direction and not look at what is actually happening right underneath our noses. The U.S. has 10 times the rate of child firearm deaths compared to our neighbors to the north, Canada, and they are the next highest country of developed countries of similar status and wealth. I'm personally invested in this amendment because I am the parent of two young children, and it is a conversation that I have with parents when they go over for play dates. I have to talk to the parents and say, do you have a gun? How is it stored? I have to interrogate them about how this happens. Now, my kids are smart. I've had a lot of good conversations with them about firearm safety, about what it looks like. You know, I shot my first gun when I was about 10 years old, so I am not ignorant in this. I was taught firearm safety. But the reality is, the situation that we find ourselves in is out of control. And even kids that are smart, even kids that are trained, they are curious. They want to know, they want to hold it, they want to feel it. And the fact of the matter is, this leads to death. If there were five children that had died for some other reason between June and December, we would be appalled. If five children starved to death in our communities, we would not allow that to continue. And yet here we are with an easy fix that we know will dramatically reduce firearm deaths in children. And I think this is a great opportunity for us to move forward on it. I do want to address the fact that safe storage laws, especially with these enhanced storage requirements, show significantly fewer deaths from firearms, 78% lower than states with no secure storage laws, 78%. That means that there would only be two people on the list, two children on the list that I have here, which is still too many. And I haven't even addressed the fact that safe storage protects folks who are looking at self-harm. I don't know about you all, but I have had people in my life who have died by suicide using a firearm. And it is one of the most horrifying experiences. And I know that if you have had this happen to you, you have thought back on it and thought, what could I have done to change this? How could I have prevented this? What could I have said or done that would have made this better? Well, I've got an answer for you. It's right here. Because we know that most people, when they decide to take their own lives, make a split-second decision. It takes less than 10 minutes to decide what they're going to do. If they have something that impedes them in that moment, the chances of being able to find somebody to find some resources, are significantly higher. We can reduce deaths by suicide if we adopt safe and secure storage. I don't want to go on and on because this isn't a bill. This is just an amendment. I'm sorry. I'm just passionate about it. But I hope that we can get a bipartisan yes on this amendment, and I look forward to the conversation.
Chair Bliss.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. You know, I appreciate the stats that you gave with the children, and unfortunately, that's a horrible situation. The truth of the matter is, our current gun laws do cover those situations of the negligent storage laws that I'm sure those gun owners would have been prosecuted under that one. This particular bill, however, is one of my favorite bills because it does something that a lot of bills didn't do. We got close to 80 county sheriffs to write a letter of active opposition to this bill. Last year, the Minnesota Sheriffs Association came out very strongly against this bill. And unfortunately, the bill is too broad. It also affects 85-year-old gentleman in my district that lives by himself 2 miles away from anybody else and has no visitors. Again, I brought up the fact on debate on the floor, his house was nearly broken into by a bear. He had a loaded shotgun by his door. He was able to chase the bear off. If his daughter were to call on him on a welfare check, the sheriff comes into his house and sees a shotgun sitting by his door. The sheriff is now is required to find him guilty of this bill. So this bill is way too broad. I do not support it at all. Thank you.
Representative Owens, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bliss. I'm sad to hear that. I hope that we can work on maybe figuring out a way to make it more acceptable more to your liking. But of course, I would still encourage a yes vote. I would love for folks to think about the five children that I have listed here who would be potentially be alive if this bill had passed last year when we got out of session.
I'm sorry, I was distracted. Was that a question, Representative Hollins?
No.
Or just closing?
No.
Okay. Representative Hudson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're doing things a little bit out of the traditional order just because of the little bit of confusion on our part. But I did want to speak to this amendment, actually both of the amendments that are that we're going to hear, so I won't have to repeat myself the second time. As has been pointed out, both of these amendments are repackaged bills from the last term that were thoroughly discussed in public safety at that time. And those bills were so off the chart in terms of being unworkable that even with full trifecta control, Democrats were not able to get these provisions passed into law. What I want to point specifically on this amendment to is in lines 2.8 through 2.11, you'll notice language that's been crossed out. The language that's been crossed out says that a person is guilty of a gross misdemeanor who negligently stores or leaves a loaded firearm in a location where the person knows or reasonably should know that a child is likely to gain access unless reasonable action is taken to secure the firearm against access by the child. So that's current state law. We're hearing the same thing today that we heard last term when we were discussing these issues. The presentation of the status quo as somehow the wild, wild west, as if you could just have guns lying about anywhere with no consequence. That's obviously not the case under current state law. This bill or this amendment first creates a problem in order to turn around and fix it in a different way. And it's worth noting the difference between the two solutions. The existing solution in state law is to appeal to the well-worn legal premise of reasonability, reasonable action. And it allows a range of potential responses that are appropriate in given context, such as your neighbor who lives by himself out in the middle of nowhere and never has any visitors and doesn't have any kids. That is a totally different context than somebody who runs an active daycare center. What's reasonable in one scenario would not be reasonable in the other. So what this amendment does is it takes away the ability of prosecutors and judges to be able to apply that standard. And it says, no, very specifically in all circumstances, you must have your weapon secured in the way we say it should be secured, no matter what the context is and no matter how it affects your ability to respond reasonably in your own self-defense. It was a bad law when it was introduced last term. That's why it wasn't even able to get moved by the Democrat trifecta. It remains a bad idea now. Let's vote it down, please. Thank you.
To the maker of the Representative Pinto.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, as somebody who's actually, I have charged 609, 666, Subdivision 2 several times. And I just want to highlight for the committee and for Representative Hudson, the word that was sort of, as you read that quote of the language, you slipped right over that word, likely to gain access. So if by what you're saying, you're okay with a situation where a child may gain access, may likely to gain access is actually a reasonably high standard. And that's a challenge, right? Is that you talked about guns being all over the place. Well, the challenge is that I've got to prove as a prosecutor the child is likely to gain access. And we just know that kids right now are gaining access in all kinds of ways. And so the problem is that the way that the law works right now, it's true, there are situations that can be charged. I have charged them. And there are many situations, tragically, as Representative Hollins described, where, in fact, kids are getting access. They get access. And, in fact, you cannot charge them with a crime that the way that works. And my understanding is that this is the standard that is taught to folks in firearm training about how they're supposed to be storing their guns. So I just wanted to make that clarification.
To the maker of the amendment, Representative Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I love that Representative Pinto was able to give the sort of real world boots on the ground explanation as a prosecutor. I think that's really helpful. And my version of this is a little maybe more pedestrian. But what I would push back on is we don't let people. When you are dealing with something that is highly dangerous and it's totally designed to kill things, That is the point of it. We don't, a reasonableness standard is not what we are looking at. It is, you know, if you think about seatbelt laws, we don't say like, well, use your seatbelt when you think it's reasonable. We're like, no, you're driving a two-ton vehicle around. You use your seatbelt all the time because we don't want you flying through a windshield. That's the same situation that we're having here. I think when we look at asking people to judge what is reasonable, we have seen time and time again that folks do not have a good sense of when there is a possibility of children getting access to firearms. And I'll point out, Representative Hudson's defense of this doesn't take into account adults who are suicidal, which you might think that your gun is very reasonable sitting there loaded. And the fact of the matter is your partner is considering taking their own life. And so it is not a good standard to use. I don't think it's an acceptable standard. And I think it's very logical that we move to something that's higher, because clearly the deaths that have been happening reflect the fact that the system that we have is not working. All you have to do is look at the news. It doesn't require anything more than that.
Roll call being called. Please do a roll call of the members.
Novotny?
No.
Witte?
No.
Moeller?
Yes.
Berg?
Yes.
Bliss?
No.
Curran?
Yes.
Duren?
No.
Engen?
No.
Weiss is absent. Greenman?
Yes.
Harder?
No.
Hollins?
Yes.
Hudson?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Pinto?
Yes.
Ream?
Yes.
Rapinski?
No.
Schwartz?
No.
Steer?
No.
With 8 ayes and 10 nays, the amendment fails. There's an amendment at the desk. A2, who will be offering the A2 amendment?
That'll be me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto, describe your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, yes, I do move the A2 amendment. Members, this is language that passed the House last year as House File 601. This is a provision that would require that a person report the loss or theft of a firearm to law enforcement within 48 hours of the time that they know or reasonably should know of the loss or theft. Failure to do so, I'll point out, is a petty misdemeanor, so the equivalent of a speeding ticket. But if somebody does it a couple times, then that would move into becoming a crime. There's immunity, et cetera. Members, to remind you, and we pointed out about advocacy groups in favor opposed this bill was supported by the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. And I would think it was because the fact that the theft of guns and then diversion into illegal gun trafficking is a major concern. In a recent 4-year period, more than 260,000 guns stolen across the U.S. That's one every 2 minutes. A reminder that our licensed gun dealers are required under federal law to report lost or stolen guns within 48 hours. So they're required to do so. And yet there's not that requirement for private citizens to do the same. And members, what I have found in my work is that later on when a gun is being used in a crime and law enforcement's attempting to figure out, and presumably again this is why the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association is supportive, trying to figure out where did that gun come from, and somebody says, wait a second, actually that was stolen back then, but they didn't actually report that at the time. We want to make sure that there's not efforts to go around Minnesota's systems of making sure we have background checks, et cetera. For all these reasons, members, I would urge the support of the amendment. And I guess I'd like to add as well to something Representative Hollins had talked about. It happened that about an hour ago I was meeting with, maybe a little more than that now, meeting with pediatricians from my district, and they brought up several health-related issues. But we only talked about a couple issues, and the one that was major for all of them was, in fact, gun violence, the impact on kids. And they were pleading with me and saying it is impossible. Two of them were residents, so going through a program, they said it is impossible for somebody to go through pediatric residency and not see shot kids that they're treating. Like that is how it works. And they pleaded, please do something about gun violence, take action. They're pleased with the steps we've taken and they're asking us to do more. With the right of being a firearms owner comes with responsibilities. Responsibility is saying, hey, if your gun gets lost or stolen, then let law enforcement know that, and please make sure that you do that, and that's what this bill would do. And, Mr. Chair, I do request a roll call on the amendment.
Roll call has been requested. Any questions to the amendment? Lead Mohler? Chair Bliss?
You have something to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, I personally, if a gun was stolen from my residence, I would report it. But this bill sets a timeline arbitrarily and makes victims out of criminals out of victims. And I do not support this.
Thank you, Chair Bliss. Is there any other discussion on the amendment? Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for... I guess, is it appropriate for me to ask Representative Bliss a question? Is that okay?
He's there.
He's there. My question is, what is the appropriate timeline that you would like to see? If this is too short of a timeline to report, then what would be appropriate?
Well, as you stated previously, again, with that other bill, that reasonableness is a judgment call, and that people, I believe your statement was that we can't trust the people with the reasonableness, so we have to set these guidelines for them. And I'm afraid that an activist judge would say, if I was away from my home for 72 hours and I come home and I find out that I have a break-in, that there is an activist judge that would say, well, your neighbor should have called you. And it just, again, it makes victims out of criminals. So to require a timeline that says you should know by this time that your gun is gone. And, I guess if I had one gun, maybe I would know if that was gone, maybe two, I don't know. But if you have, for instance, I take my pheasant hunting gun. I clean it after pheasant hunting, I store it. I don't touch that gun for another year. And then I might take out my deer hunting gun or my target practice gun. I don't go checking on my guns every other day and visit with them. Although sometimes, it's nice to look at them. But, what I'm saying is that basically, I'll put my gun away and I won't touch it again for a year. And if I have a 48-hour window to report this gun stolen, that's just not right.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. I don't think I have a follow-up question. Just that I think, from my perspective, this is a good idea of a bill. I hear what you're saying, that might not work for you. But I do think that there is a way that we can make this workable. And I'm not sure what it is, but I think that law enforcement wants us to report when there are lost and stolen guns. Certainly people in my community, because we have gang activity that deals in lost and stolen guns, and so that's something that's important to my community. So I feel like there is a way that we can move forward with this, maybe not today, but in the future. Thank you.
Lee Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to comment on what Representative Bliss just said. The prosecutor has to be able to prove that the person knew or reasonably should have known of the loss or theft. So if you're cleaning your gun after hunting and putting it away and someone's come into your house and taken it, you don't know, the prosecutor is going to have a hard time proving that you reasonably should have known of the theft. Now, if someone breaks into your house and everything is all in disarray and you can tell things have been stolen, and the gun safe is open, well, then you would have reason to know in that situation that, should at least look, and then if the gun is not there, would have reason to know. So I just want to make it clear that in that scenario, would be very difficult to prosecute someone.
Chair Bliss, response?
Yeah, and again, maybe that was a wrong example, but maybe if I go in there and the gun is stolen between pheasant season and deer season, and I go into my gun safe and access it, and I have a few shotguns. I never like to travel 8 to 10 hours to go hunting without his backup. So I don't check my other guns. But if a prosecutor would know that I got in there, 3 weeks after I stored my shotgun and I had a shotgun missing or a target rifle or one of my handguns that I don't necessarily get to all the time, you know, I was in my safe. I should have known that gun was gone. That it's just, again, it's an arbitrary standard, and I don't support it. I do support reporting firearms when they're stolen.
Thank you. I'll make my comment. I think I was 25 years old before I had a house that had a key. To the maker of the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate what you say about Tribulus about kind of the standard you'd hold yourself to. I feel like we've had that in a number of our bills relating to guns where it feels, at least from our side or from me, that we're just asking that other folks hold themselves to the same standard as the responsible gun owners. That may include you and some of your colleagues, that that's really what we're trying to do. Appreciate Chairman Mueller's, Representative Mueller's comment, Lee Mueller's comment about reasonably should have known. So I think that that does cover a lot, but maybe I'm feeling especially philosophical because I'm meeting with the pediatricians. But it does feel to me, members, like there's got to be a way we can make some progress when it comes to gun safety, and again, especially for kids and for those pediatricians. So, you know, if this is not, I think this works as it is. I certainly hope all members support it. And the event that my GOP colleagues do not, I hope we can actually talk through a way on this bill and maybe on the storage bill as well. I don't know. I kind of caught there might have been some possibility there, because we need to make progress somehow. So I hope that we can figure out some ways through other conversations on behalf of the residents of Minnesota. Thank you, Chair.
Major Pintel, roll call being called. Please take the roll.
Novotny.
No.
Witte?
No.
Mueller?
Yes.
Berg?
Yes.
Bliss?
No.
Curran?
Yes.
Duren?
No.
Hengen?
No.
Vice is absent. Greenman?
Yes.
Harder?
No.
Hollins?
Yes.
Hudson?
Nope.
Johnson?
Yes.
Pinto?
Yes.
Ream?
Yes.
Rapinski?
No.
Schwartz?
No.
Steer?
No.
With 10 I, or 8 I and 10 no's, the amendment fails. We're back to the bill. Member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Chair Bliss, for bringing this bill. This really speaks to like one of the fundamental reasons why I wanted to come and do this work here at the Capitol. When we use words like freedom, it kind of evokes the question of freedom from what? And broadly speaking, I think what we should be aiming at is freedom for an individual from coercion, unlawful coercion by others. And that's what this bill reestablishes. Because currently, with this duty to retreat, it's just a curious phrase, duty to retreat. Well, retreat from what? You're retreating from a presentation, a threat of force against your person. And you're doing so in a context where you are otherwise presumably acting lawfully. So you're in a place where you have the right to be, your home, your property, public road, this chamber, and someone else presents, initiates force against you. And under the duty to retreat, you apparently no longer have the right to be where you are. That is strange. Why would we allow unlawful initiators, aggressors of force, to be able to lawfully, in effect, coerce you to leave a space where you have every right to be? Why are we empowering unlawful actors? Why are we empowering aggressors? This bill restores that, and it also restores, I believe, by a plain reading of the existing statute, the original intent of the statute before it was monkeyed with by the courts. If you look at the you can see it in the bill in lines 120 and 121, but you could also find it in the underlying statute 609.06. And by the way, we're not just talking about deadly force here. We're talking about any and all reasonable force. One of the reasons why you can use reasonable force is when it's used by any person in resisting or aiding another to resist an offense against the person, so that's protecting yourself. But then curiously, you flip the page over, lines 201.1 through 2.3, it goes on to say that force is reasonable when used by any person in lawful possession of real or personal property or by another assisting the person in lawful possession in resisting a trespass upon or other unlawful interference with such property. So under current state law, you can use reasonable force to protect your property, such as your home, your purse, your briefcase, except for this duty to retreat. Now all of a sudden you're saying, even in your own home, you have to find some way out. You're getting pushed out by this unlawful actor who's aggressing against you. It's a completely unacceptable status quo, and I thank you very much for bringing this bill. I'm looking forward to voting for it. That restores common sense.
Representative Steer. I'm sorry. I looked right at him. Representative Duran.
I don't know if I look like him.
You're better looking.
Can I have Rob Doerr come back up, please? Is that okay?
Representative Doerr is still here. What's that?
He's not enough,
right? I'm sorry. Testifier Doerr is here. Go ahead and begin your question for Mr. Doerr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard a lot of statistics today. I'm a little concerned about those. Can you kind of clarify some of the statistics that were mentioned earlier today by one of the other testifiers in regards to deaths and shoot first laws and people going off the deep end and using firearms? So can you kind of explain some of those?
Mr. Doerr.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. So I'm not sure which exactly citations were being looked at. I did, when I reviewed the written testimony that was submitted to committee, I saw a few things. One was just a statement that the states that have stand your ground have higher homicide rates than Minnesota does. That's kind of there's no correlation there that's established that because of the stand your ground laws, that's why they're higher. It's just kind of a observation without any correlation. I did review a JAMA article that had a review period from 2009 to 2017 where they found homicide rates were higher after states passed stand your ground laws, but that included all homicides, not just firearm homicides, which would seem to be the what would be the more interesting statistic. But what was very interesting was they didn't actually include justifiable homicides. And I think that's what the number we would be looking for is, after stand your ground passed, do we see an increase in the rate of justifiable homicide defenses? And while the research didn't go into that, when you review FBI's Crime Data Explorer, which tells you the number of justifiable homicides, even the justifiable homicides in those states that pass stand your ground laws, the rates don't alter by much. So there hasn't, none of the studies that I've seen or heard referenced actually establish that stand your ground means that more justifiable, you know, more people are going to get away with committing these kinds of crimes. At best, it relies on some correlation without really causation about the rate of homicides, which can be exacerbated by a wide array of both political and cultural issues beyond just a single law's passage.
Representative Duran.
So we have no clue with the statistics that is going on, that if an individual had a firearm pulled on them and they justifiably took action and defended themselves, none of the statistics in some of these places differentiate whether or not that person was in defense of their own safety, right?
Mr. Doerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative. I at least from the written testimony that was provided, I haven't seen anybody who is able to draw a line between the passage of stand your ground laws and a increase in justified homicide use or an increase in claims of justified homicide that were then dismissed. I think it's important to realize in every state in the country, force always has to be reasonable in response to an attack. So that it has to be objectively reasonable. Now, I don't get to decide what's objectively reasonable. I can try to do my best in the situation, but whether I acted reasonable is going to be judged by a police officer, a prosecutor, and a judge or a jury, depending on how I decide if I go to trial. And they are going to look at my actions and see would a person in my situation with the information I had and the tools I had available have reacted in a similar way. And if they find that I was objectively unreasonable, I'm going to be found guilty. If they find I was reasonable in the way that I responded, and that's the ultimate check to this system. So I haven't seen anything that challenges that check to the system being not insufficient to protecting people in this law.
Thank you. And, you know, someone that has been on the other side of some very serious situations in my life and has been put in multiple instances where my life has been put in danger, you know, being in law enforcement and also in combat as well, things happen relatively quick. And sometimes we don't have time to think about situations or think about the environment right there in front of us. We instinctively react to different situations. And when we get that ability to defend ourselves or to react to a certain situation, that's what it's like to be free. That's what it's like to be able to make sure that we're defending ourselves in certain situations. But right now, on how this is, Rob, would you have any idea if I would be charged, if I would instinctively defend myself at this time, deadly force situation was in front of me, and I don't have time to think about things and I just react to the situation, how does the court ruling affect that?
Mr. Doar.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think, you know, Justice Thiessen said it very well when he said this decision flies in the face of human nature, that we all are going to instinctively react. And I think the big danger of this this case is that presenting an opposing force will often de-escalate an encounter. Like once an attacker realizes that a victim is not so much an easy victim, that will more frequently than not end an attack. And with this ruling and why I think at least some legislation to clear up our confusing self-defense laws, I think it's clear that a person who presents a force option, if it's a deadly force option in the face of an attack without retreating, could face criminal charges.
Lee Moeller. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't quite sure what the lineup was. So one thing just to start with, there was a testifier who described this as a very narrow exception, and because it only refers to clause 3, line 1.20. But I would look at the other clause. I mean, clause 3, and I would think Chair Bliss would agree with this. Like that's kind of that's the whole thing because that's self-defense. I mean, the other these other ones are describing, you know, expelling somebody from a common carrier clause 8 or, you know, in schools. But I mean, this is, presumably you're bringing this bill forward, not because it's such a narrow thing, but because you want this to apply in situations where folks are facing, are needing to defend themselves. Is that right?
Again, I'm bringing this forward.
Representative Blitz.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. I'm bringing this forward because it was a recent Supreme Court case. And I got a couple of quotes here from Justice Thiessen. One, it says, appears that Minnesota is the only state to impose a duty to retreat before using non-lethal force against a deadly force. And the other one was that we're the only ones We're the only ones that apply this. Here it is. The court takes the law of self-defense into uncharted waters. This new rule is only unprecedented, or this new rule is not only unprecedented in this state. As far as I am aware, the rule has never been adopted anywhere in the United States. And again, what we're trying to do with this bill is say, and if you look at the wording, it says reasonable force. Yeah. It does not say use of deadly force. It says reasonable force. And there was a comment made earlier about some examples, I think, in Florida was where somebody was retreating and they were shot anyway. I don't think there's any judge in the state that would call that reasonable force. So this, in my opinion, it clarifies that if you're in a situation and you can display a weapon to defer or to deter attack.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Chair Bliss, am I understanding this right? So without your bill going forward, Minnesota has a rule right now that somebody being attacked, if they use force, they have to first try to retreat before they can use force. If they don't do that, that's unreasonable. Is that your understanding of kind of what the current law is without your bill?
Representative Bliss.
Thank you. I'm just quoting the Supreme Court ruling, and what Justice Thiessen, the examples he's given, is that you're not even allowed to use non-lethal force without the duty to retreat. Again, if you were to use a can of mace and spray that person that had a knife in front of you, that is non-lethal force, and unless you look for a duty to retreat, you don't have that right.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I understand it, what your bill would do is it would cause us to pull back from the current rule that a person using force to harm an attacker, that they're acting unreasonably if they don't first try to retreat. That's what your bill is about, is saying that you have to try first to retreat. And I'm going to quote Justice Thiessen as well from the very same opinion, page D6, if you've got it with you. Quote, I do not suggest in this dissent that Minnesota should pull back from its per se rule that a person using force to harm an attacker is acting unreasonably if they do not first try to retreat. Justice Thiessen is not suggesting your bill. He's extremely not suggesting your bill. Now, what's going on here is he is talking about a situation involving a threat of force. That's what he's focused on, is a threat of force. And admittedly, I can sort of see the debate there, right, a little bit. Is if you've got a threat, he's saying, well, maybe the threat is something where that itself is causing somebody to back off. Fair enough. But he is not calling for if your bill were calling for something about threats, that might be consistent with Justice Thiessen. But no, your bill is saying that reasonable force can be used. That's what your bill is about. And if we look at the situation in Blevins, and this is on pages 5 and 6. Now, in this case, it was a threat as an actual use of force. According to the Supreme Court, what was found was that the person in that case moved towards other people with this machete. He lunged at one person. He held the machete in his hand in an aggressive manner, and he yelled and swung a machete at them for approximately 1 minute. Yelled and swung a machete at people for a minute while having, the court found, the ability to retreat. I don't think that this is a set of facts that you want to rely upon for this, okay? One thing, you display the machete, yelled, lunged, threatened with machete, swung it at people for a full minute. Now, I'm not going to, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to take the committee's time and count off 60 seconds, but I could, right? We could sit here for 60 seconds and imagine a machete being swung. That's not conduct we want to encourage. That is not something that you want to be encouraging at all. Mr. Chair, you had said in response to a question yesterday, and I appreciate it, that safety for everybody in the state is the goal of this committee. That's what we're trying to do, right? The difference between a threat, as is discussed in Blevins, a threat is one thing, right? It's words, it's a concerning situation. But the difference here is, and the reason we want people to retreat if they reasonably can, is because the problem is, if you retreat, there's not physical harm going on, right? As soon as there is reasonable force, as soon as there's an actual assault, after that, you've got injury. You've got grievous injury. You've got potentially death. So that is the reason that Justice Thiessen and the other justices are saying they don't want to change our per se rule that a duty to retreat is present, that you have to first try to retreat and that it's unreasonable to do so if you cannot reasonably retreat. They support that. That's what your bill is about. If you want to have a conversation about threats that consist with Justice Thiessen's perspective, that makes a lot of sense. That is not what your bill does. And as the Minnesota County Attorneys describe, our system right now is working very well, and this is something that would absolutely put us in a very, very dangerous place, so we need to vote against. Thank you, Chair.
Chair Bliss, do you care to quickly respond to that before we go to Representative Kern, and we've got another bill to go to, and I assume that Representative Mueller will have a question, too. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. No specific question. I just respectfully want to just, you know, sort of state my position on this as a gun owner, as somebody who cares about public safety, as somebody who served as a police officer and a dispatcher. I think, you know, because these situations are so complex and unique, all of the situations that we've talked about have their own components, backstories of people involved, all of these things, right, that it just make these situations so complex that I think the courts are actually the appropriate place to have these conversations based on the individual facts of each case in determining whether or not somebody could have retreated or whether or not there was no option to retreat. I don't agree with the premise that one would need to know and understand all case law. I think in that quick fight or flight moment, if you've got room to create space in any situation that could become volatile, space is your best friend. There's like 99% of situations where space is going to be your best friend from somebody getting hurt to physically harmed in a situation. I don't think this bill gets at that approach to public safety and trying to create distance and space before engaging with somebody. And I have general concerns about unnecessary violence as a result of this change and just putting people in a position where they might feel like they have to commit violence up to and including homicide and then live with that, then live with those consequences when there could have been other outcomes. So I've got some general concerns about this. I think the courts are the right place to make these determinations, and I think the law as it stands is the right way to go. Thank you.
Lee Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bliss. Before I forget, I do want to request a roll call on this bill. Excuse me. And I just want to thank those people who testified, also submitted letters, a lot of great letters in the packet as well. I was going to read this, but in the sake of time, I will not. Also looking at the majority opinion, we've talked a lot about the dissent in this case, but we actually have the court's majority opinion in Blevins, and there was discussion about the dissent's hypothetical involving pepper spray, and the majority directly addresses that on page 15 and 16 and explains why the dissent's hypothetical is not realistic. We have also heard, I think it was sort of suggested maybe, that you'd have a duty to retreat in your home. You do not. That has been determined. You don't have to retreat when you are in your home. And the other thing I wanted to just ask Mr. Johnson is how long has the duty to retreat been in place? Because it comes from common law, and it sounded like there was testimony suggesting it's not been in existence that long.
Mr. Johnson.
Chair Novotny, Representative Mueller, and members, the duty to retreat dates to the English common law. It's at least the 1600s in England. Came to the United States based on that English common law. The first case in Minnesota saying that people had a duty to retreat before using self-defense was 1865. That's State versus Shippey. It's repeated in 1884 in State v. Sorensen, and again in 1905 in State versus Garner. The statute that's in front of you now was created in 1963, so the more recent cases were in response to the adoption of the statutory right, which is 1963.
Lead Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Johnson, for that. So as we heard, this doctrine has been around for literally hundreds of years. It is working, and I don't think we need to change the law, and I'm going to recommend a no vote.
I'll take my chair. I can think of two situations specifically where the racking of a shotgun got an empty building to suddenly have someone decide that they were present and they did want to be arrested before the building was searched. And then as I think about that, the countless times the barking of a canine, which probably is a use of force and it would be considered under this. brief closing, Chair Bliss, before sure. we take the roll call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a brief example of a racking of a shotgun. It included a bear, and he decided he didn't want to be around after that racking, too. So that works for a lot of different creatures. Again, this is a common sense bill. It uses the time-tested term reasonable force, reasonable use of force. Again, nowhere in statute does it state that there is a duty to retreat, but we are adding it with this, that there is no duty to retreat if you are in protection of somebody else or yourself. And I think, again, it's just common sense, and I appreciate a yes vote.
With that, we'll take the roll call.
Novotny?
Yes.
Witte?
Yes.
Moeller?
No.
Berg?
No.
Bliss?
Yes.
Curran?
No.
Duren?
Yes.
Engen?
Yes.
Feist is absent. Greenman?
No.
Collins?
No.
Carter?
Yes.
Hudson?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Pinto?
No.
Ream?
No.
Rapinski?
Yes.
Schwartz?
Yes.
Steer?
Yes.
With 10 aye and 8 nay, the bill is moved to the, is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Chair Bliss. Got about 8 minutes left. Chair Moeller, would you allow a run a little late today, or we should be able to go this pretty quick? Last bill on the agenda is House File 924. Chair Nash, please come to the table with your testifier. Chair Nash, since you are not a member of this committee, I will move your bill before the committee with a recommendation that the bill is re-referred to the General Register. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good to be here in public safety today. The House File 924 is really a technical fix to a bill that was a bipartisan bill back in 2015 when I passed it. In 2015, the bill that I passed said that if you are a permit to carry holder, it constituted notification of the fact that you were going to be carrying a sidearm at the Capitol. In my youthful exuberance, I was not pointed out that a retired policeman was not required to have a permit to carry in order to carry their sidearm. And this is literally a technical fix to say that if you are a retired peace officer, that you do not have to go get a permit to carry. They are some of the most trained individuals that we have, as the chair will be able to attest. So, and as Representative Witte as well. So this is simply a technical fix to the language that we had back in 2015 that was actually, Mr. Diebel helped me draft that. And again, Senator Latz helped get it through the Senate, and it was a bipartisan vote on the floor. So I would appreciate your support.
Chair Nash, you have a testifier who is here, and I thank him for sticking.
I don't think we do.
Maybe Mr. Felber?
That is not my deed. Oh, we do have a testifier. Sorry about that. Sometimes I forget.
Mr. Felber, please state your full name and begin your testimony, please, briefly.
My name is Greg Charles Felber. I am worked 25 years for the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department, retired from there, worked part-time for Corcoran for 2 years after that. I've been doing Minnesota use of force training on and off, both civilian and military, since about 1989, so I'm fairly familiar with the laws. I am currently, I believe I should mention this, I'm currently a Sherburne County Commissioner, so I do hold an elected position at all, although this doesn't really reflect on that. Allowing people who are carrying under the licensed peace officers can take an annual training that includes a training in the law and an actual shooting qualification every single year to carry under United States Code Title 18, Part 1, Chapter 44, Section 90C. So it's commonly referred to as H.R. 218, the Law Enforcement Officer Safety Act. This training allows a retired law enforcement officer to carry in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. It is virtually the only way that somebody who is a non-resident can carry in the District of Columbia. So allowing people with that kind of training to have the same access to the Capitol, to me, would make complete sense. They have the training, they have the ability, and in general, even though we're all retired, we're no longer cops, we have a tendency to step up to help stop threats to the general public. It's more of a habit after a number of years of doing it. Most police officers who do carry after they're retired carry all the time. They carry everywhere they go. And this law also applies to courthouses. In a courthouse, if you're going into the courthouse, you're going to see a sign that says you can't bring your firearm in here. Unless you have made some arrangements in previous, or if you're on duty. But this building doesn't have that kind of signage. So it'd be extremely easy for someone who is a retired law enforcement officer to walk in here inadvertently and commit a felony. And I think that that is really a travesty.
Will that be all?
Is that? Yes, that'll be
Thank
it.
You. Thank you.
There is an amendment at the table. DE1, who will be presenting the amendment?
I will, Mr. Chair.
Lead Moeller, explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I forget, I'm going to ask for a roll call on the DE1. And I've talked to Representative Nash about his bill. I'm planning on voting for it. Well, we texted about it. He looked confused. But I am planning on voting for the bill and itself, but the provision of law that your bill is addressing has to do with Capitol security and carrying firearms on the Capitol grounds. And so this amendment establishes that only Capitol security and licensed peace officers performing official duties would be able to carry pistols on Capitol grounds. And the reason why we want to do that is because there are probably over 30 states now who ban firearms in their state capitals. And it is amazing when people come here to visit us and are astounded at, I would just say, the fact that people can so openly carry firearms here. And there are many states, like I mentioned before, and many red states, Alabama, North Dakota, Tennessee, West Virginia, that ban firearms in their capital complexes. And I think it's time for us to do that in Minnesota. I know the laws, you know, changed over the years and you've worked on this provision, but we have seen an escalating amount of political violence in this country. There was a report from Brennan Center at New York. They did over 1,700 officials from 50 states and asked them about elected officials about security. More than 40% of state legislators experienced threats or attacks within the past 3 years. It was more women than men. It was actually more Republicans than Democrats. And then we just, you know, like I said, in recent years, there has been an escalation starting from Gabby Giffords. We heard from her organization in 2011. We had the baseball, the Republican congressional baseball game. There was shooting there in 2017. In 2020, there was an attempt to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Of course, we had the January 6th insurrection on 2021. In Wisconsin, they had an incident involving their governor in 2023. And then, of course, President Trump, there was an assassination attempt. So I really think now is the time for us to be increasing our security and limiting who can carry firearms in the Capitol. Thank you.
Representative Nash, do you support this amendment?
Mr. Chair, I would encourage a no vote for a couple different reasons. One, in your amendment, Representative Mueller, in lines 2.12 through 2.15, you're effectively constraining those retired peace officers that can carry here at the Capitol to only those who we pejoratively call the gold ties or the yellow ties. If your amendment, if it was adopted, would preclude folks like our chair and our vice chair. So I believe that is not your intent, but I oppose your amendment, and we can talk about the safety of the Capitol maybe in another bill, but this is simply to clarify language that as a retired peace officer, you are entitled to carry here at the Capitol. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Moeller or Lead Moeller?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just say I'm more than happy to work on language, and if that would be expanded to include all retired peace officers, that's certainly something that we could discuss, but I don't think it's a reason to vote no on this amendment now, and I am going to request yes vote.
Roll call has been called. Please take the roll.
Novotny?
No.
Witte?
No.
Moeller?
Yes.
Berg?
Yes.
Bliss?
No.
Curran?
Yes.
Duren?
No.
Engen?
No.
Feist is absent. Greenman?
Yes.
Harder?
No.
Collins?
Yes.
Hudson?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Pinto?
Yes.
Ream?
Yes.
Rapinski?
No.
Schwartz?
No.
Steer?
No.
With 8 ayes and 10 nays, the amendment fails. Representative Nash, to your bill. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have nothing further. I do appreciate Chair Mueller's or Representative Mueller's admonition to vote yes. This is a very straightforward approach to clean up a loophole that was inadvertently caused back in 2015. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lead Mueller, voice vote.
That's fine.
All in favor of the motion or of the bill, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Nash, your bill will be re-referred to the General Registry. Thank you, Chair, and the testifiers. There being no further business to come before the committee, the next committee will be on Tuesday, March 4th at 3 p.m. There being no further business, this meeting is adjourned.